and welcome. I'm Hank Dittmar, and I'm joined by Doug Kelbaugh and Robin Rather for a discussion on cities and sustainability. And I think we're all going to sort of look at sustainability writ large rather than sustainability writ small in terms of just energy conservation. If you could dim the lights a bit. Is that all right for everyone? I'm from the Prince's Foundation. You heard from my boss earlier today, so I won't dwell on that. Just to say that we're a charity that works on practice-based learning. We do live projects from which we try to create tools and then teach. And we're one of 24 charities founded by the Prince of Wales, and together we're about a 200 million pound social enterprise. This is part of the challenge in terms of sustainability. It's the mean change in global temperatures over the last 100 years, and projected over the next 100 years from the IPCC, and I promised Al Gore I would show this in every presentation. This is the practical effect of a series of mistakes, I think. It's more volatility and intensity in storms, which some people believe is really a result of global climate change, but also the channelization of our river systems across the developing world, and patterns of building which really ignore long-term ideas about the natural environment, led to massive flooding across England in the last year, both in the north of England and here in Gloucestershire. Ed Masria, who appeared here last year, talks about the 2030 challenge, and he shows this to show that we should really focus on buildings. But if you look at transport, you'll see that it's also a major part of it. And so the built environment is a majority of the carbon emissions that we have to deal with. But that's only one side of the sustainability question. And most of the discussion here at the Congress has been really from an American point of view, about thinking about how we in this country mitigate and deal with climate change from a position of being the largest consumers of greenhouse gas emissions per capita in the world. 2.1 billion more people will live in cities by 2030, and that's of a total 2.2 billion people. And by and large, this map, which shows the present urban concentration, will be replaced by a different map. And this map kind of shows what's happened over the last number of years from the United Nations. And this is megacities, big cities in 1955, at the present day, and what's expected to be the case in 2015. And you'll see the dramatic impact on the Indian subcontinent in China and Southeast Asia, Africa and South America and Central America, of the growth of huge urban populations, people moving from the countryside into the city and creating massive cities. And there's a whole other layer of not huge cities, but regular-sized cities also growing. And so to deal with this, for the most part, people in these cities are not living in great conditions. They're living in conditions in areas that are rife with cholera, where sanitation is not in place, and where poverty is endemic. And so we see here poverty as an issue, and a resizing of the map of the world to think about the relative size of parts of the world afflicted with poverty. And the United Nations has set a series of Millennium Development Goals that deal with the very real issues of poverty and malnutrition and sanitation and environmental sustainability in terms of things like dealing with close by pollution from coal plants. And so for these parts of the world, the issue is this, that there are two cities within one city one part of the urban population that has all the benefits of urban living, and the other part the slums and squatter settlements, where the poor often live under worse conditions than their rural relatives. And so this was pointed up by the session that Dhiru Thadani and Jaime Correa did, where they looked at both sides of this equation. But as we begin to deal with the question of sustainability here, which is about consumption, and we're talking about consuming less, are we sending a message to the developing world that we want them to forego the benefits of the quality of life improvements that we have had? This map is a similar one, which resizes the globe in terms of carbon emissions. And let me show that again. Watch Canada relative to the U.S. And watch Africa disappear. So these countries who are coming up the curve in terms of carbon really view global warming as the repository of a Western way of life, and they view any diversion of development dollars to deal with climate change as actually using money that should be used to help them improve their standards of living as money that is now then paying for a problem caused by the West. And these areas are often most afflicted with the problems of sea level rise as well. And so we see here the portion of the population that's afflicted with sea level rise around, threatened by sea level rise around the world. And they are very much dealing not just with the question of mitigating climate change, but also with the question of adapting it. And we are all going to have to live with the question of migration from these countries as we begin to deal with these questions. What this all comes down to is the idea of an ecological footprint. And this is a resizing of the map of the world to where we actually look like our waistlines here in the Western world. And the sizes of the countries that are not consuming so many resources are shrunken. Very powerful way of thinking about the distribution of resources and the challenges that we are facing. Well, what this leads to, I think, is a different way of thinking about how we are going to deal with climate change and to deal with the questions of environmental impact. Heretofore, in the last 100 years, what's really happened is that as people's standards of living have risen, they have consumed more non-renewable resources. And there's been a real belief that actually that's what you need to do to get people up the curve is that actually vehicle miles traveled and GDP are linked, and that actually building more roads to stimulate more GDP to stimulate more vehicle miles traveled actually creates GDP. Well, we're thinking in Europe now, we're thinking that actually we need to decouple those. And this shows the two kinds of decoupling that need to take place. The first is the decoupling of resource use from economic growth. And the second, then, is the decoupling of environmental impact from resource use. And if we want to have a chance of actually doing this as one planet, we have to make this actually begin to happen in a way that allows people in the developing world and in the southern hemisphere to actually improve their quality of life without consuming in the same way. And it's beginning to happen in Europe. And we can see here that there are beginning to be differences in terms of both resource use and energy consumption from the GDP curve. And England and the EU has adopted this now as a policy, the decoupling of things. And this would be a step, I think, that would be, if the U.S. were to take this kind of goal-setting step, it would be seen as a very positive thing around the developing world. Well, urbanism, I think, this is something that brings us back to the question of what is the CNU's role. Really, this brings us back to understanding that actually it is, as we say in our charter, one interrelated community building challenge. Sustainability is not just about energy conservation and efficiency, but also about poverty, sanitation, health, and prosperity. And better urbanism offers the opportunity to do this decoupling and begin to address issues of sanitation, issues of the provision of services, the relation of people in the slums to work, and a variety of other things. And third, I think that we can't leave out, because it's about resource use, we can't leave out architecture, materials use, or building technology and practice from this question of how we're going to achieve this decoupling. And finally, I had a debate with someone earlier in the day about the canons, where we were talking about passive low-tech solutions, and I think that may not be so necessary in this country, but for worldwide application, we really need to be looking at flexible and adaptable, simple, resilient solutions to dealing with all of these problems. And so relying on the high-tech fix in Sierra Leone, where we're working, is not going to get there, because no one will actually maintain that high tech. We saw their computer-aided design system for the planning systems in Sierra Leone, and they hadn't been turned on in 15 years. So that's a sort of a canter through a prism for thinking about these questions that's begun to shape my thinking about how we at the Prince's Foundation deal with questions of sustainability, really as systemic questions, and as questions that are about our approach to urbanism. And I want to canter through a few examples. One, looking at density and the kind of densities that can reduce vehicle travel from a project that we're doing in Walthamstow. A quick example from Sherford, which we've been doing with Paul Moraine in Plymouth, and a few examples of projects that are getting started in really post-conflict settings and more difficult settings around the world. Walthamstow is an outer London town center, the end of the Victoria Line, and also on railway line. You can get to the financial district, the city, in 22 minutes, and to the West End in 18 minutes. It's very accessible, but it's a one-story sort of one and two-story sort of Victorian town center, dominated by a one-story shopping mall in the center from the 70s. We began to look at the question of how to meet the London plan standards for reducing climate impact, and also their ambitious standards for dealing with housing affordability, by getting new houses into the center of Walthamstow. And we were guided by this map, which John Norquist showed earlier today, that I produced with my colleagues at the Center for Neighborhood Technology in the 90s. And it shows carbon emissions as per square mile basis on the left in Chicago, and on a per capita basis on the right in Chicago. It begins to show that density, urbanity, public transport, and connected streets are the answer to reducing carbon emissions. From my colleagues and good colleagues Newman and Kenworthy, this is a chart that shows the same thing, plotted as jobs and housing together against per capita car use in 58 metropolitan areas around the world. And you see a curve that shows that as density increases, automobile use decreases. And so we decided to build this model for London, looking at three factors: residential density, public transport connectivity, public transport accessibility, and street connectivity, the basic features of urban design and new urbanism. And we found that actually in London that the same thing works as in Chicago, that as you near the more connected parts of the city, car use declines, walking and public transport use increases, and carbon emissions decrease. And so we thought we'd try to build a model for assessing the climate impacts of our urban design changes in Walthamstow using the figures generated in London. In Walthamstow, there was a lot of concern about density because the first building the mayor's density program had brought about was a 14-story slab tower block, which reminded everyone of the slab tower blocks that had been built in London in the 1960s. So no one wanted that imposed in their community. So we took a look around London at some of the most location-efficient areas, Swiss Cottage, Kensington, and Chelsea. And then we looked at the building typologies that predominated in those areas, and we found that they were largely 4 to 6-story terraces and courtyard apartment buildings. And we decided to try with 3 different models to see what we could get in terms of density there. And we discovered, actually, that with terraced houses and mansion blocks, we were getting as much density as was required in the mayor's plan. And so we did that on an underutilized set of industrial land below the railway line there and on the shopping center. We replaced it with mansion blocks, which are courtyard flats and terraced housing, and then created a walkable and interconnected replacement to the 4 to 6-story replacement to the shopping center, and found dramatic reductions in vehicle mile traveled against the typical London, outer London development. So we're providing, I think, it's sort of a no-brainer, but it's actually evidence that's modeled about the fact that if you do this right, you get density, public transport, and you increase permeability, people will drive less and you'll get carbon reductions. And we also got 2,438 new households into the area and got a plan that was approved by 65% of the residents in Walthamstow. So it's been adopted. And Transport for London, which owns the site now, has come back and said they want a tall building. They want a tower on the land that they own so they can get more value out of it. So now we're working to show them that actually we can make more money on their site by doing 6-story buildings, which we think we can. Sherford, which is a project we're doing with, is really a new eco town. It's a project we're doing with a developer outside of Plymouth. We'll have 5,500 homes, a town center with retail and employment. Up to 50% of them will be affordable, and it's built around a rapid bus connection on the main high street into Plymouth. And so the arterial, as you can see here, is actually at the center of the, the main road that comes through the site with the rapid bus and all of the retail and office, the centers of the 3 neighborhoods, and you can see that here now, are oriented around that, the rapid bus line offers quick access into Plymouth. It's centered around, it replaces an earlier plan that had 4 sort of suburban pods scattered across that land, and what we were able to do by creating a single town was save about 45% of the land for a country park, which is linked through a green infrastructure and sustainable urban drainage through all of the neighborhoods. It's being seen as one of the prototypes for the new set of eco-towns that are being promoted in England at this time. We think it's going to go forward into construction this year. It was rated as the first exemplar project in the Green Print Review, which is the lead ND of England, for its transport connectivity and placemaking and integration of ecology. Just for Austinites who are here, we invented a new thing called the bat block for Sherford, because we had to preserve the bat flyways to a country house outside of the site. And so Paul Moraine came up with a very nice block type that has a green flyway in the back of the block to allow the bats to happily fly at night out of the neighborhood through and get into that green space and then go to the place where they chow down. Oh, thank you. Just quickly, another project we're doing in Scotland with Urban Design Associates, Ellen, which is an extension of a small town outside of Aberdeen, which again is going to employ a new green building materials that we're working on, and has aspirations to really reduce car use in that auto-centered way. And it involves both the revitalization of the town center and a series of new neighborhoods that also reconnect the suburban neighborhoods that were constructed over the last 20 years back to the town center through a set of steps. I'm going to just do a few more slides and then stop. We're working internationally. The Prince has asked us to get involved in a series of issues, the explosion of urban population in slum settings, the reconciliation of climate change and Millennium Development Goals, and helping the rediscovery of traditional urbanism and vernacular approaches to climate, ecology, and local materials, and finally adapting to sea level rise. And that's His Royal Highness demonstrating his prowess at reggae with some of the reggae stars on a recent visit to Kingston, Jamaica, where we're working. In Freetown, Sierra Leone, we are about to begin a project which anyone who wants to volunteer for can join us in. It's a site that's been torn by war, and we're looking at both the dealing with issues of sanitation in a slum called Crew Bay, which is built, I don't know if you can see it, there's a stream that runs through the middle of the site down to the beach. And essentially what they do is they pull garbage out of the stream to create fill, and then they go to the beach and drag sand up to put on top of the garbage and build their houses on top of that. And so we're working in that community to try to think about how do you create basic sanitation, and also then at an outlying community outside of Sierra Leone, which was connected by a rail line, to try to reestablish transport access so that people who move there can have access to jobs. Because the main problem that seems to happen is that when people are relocated from slums, they take them away from where the jobs are, and so people just go back to the slums. So it is that job housing question. In Beijing, we're working with Tsinghua University to look at keeping the hutongs, the traditional courtyard houses, alive. And not turn them into backpacker hostels, actually, to try to create a place where they actually work for people to live in. And in Kabul, Afghanistan, we're working with the Turquoise Mountain Foundation, which is another one of the Prince's charities, to create a master plan. They've established a school for traditional architecture and mud brick reconstruction of this neighborhood. And we're performing master planning services and debating with the Soviet-trained master planners about how to reintroduce traditional urbanism in small blocks. And Douglas Dwani has been leading that effort for us. It's all very Lawrence of Arabia and scary. And in Jizan, we're developing. This is the master plan from Sharad a few months ago, where we have done a mixed-use, mixed-income neighborhood for the King's Foundation there, which will integrate affordable housing for the very poor with mixed-income housing for really, I think, the first mixed-income project in Saudi Arabia, and perhaps the first mixed Sharad with men and women in Saudi Arabia that has been done. And in Kingston, Jamaica, we did a charrette with DPZ, which they led to develop a master plan, which we've been evolving to bring together two neighborhoods that were blown apart by gang violence with a neighborhood center. And it's an effort to try to bring both civil society and urbanism together there, and to get different community groups to begin working together, but at the same time, build skills for the rebuilding of the community and create a job base there. And that's a library that we're that the Prince just opened a few weeks ago This is sort of, and unlike most projects in Jamaica where they just tear down the houses and build whatever the new ones are, we're hoping to actually work with people to provide low interest loans and skills to rehabilitate the existing houses, because they're actually much better than what could be built today. So I think that I will stop at that point ask Doug to come up. So thank you for your time, and I hope that gives you a slightly broader set of thoughts about sustainability and climate change.
Well, I'm listed as a respondent. I'm not really going to respond per se. I'm going to go off script a little bit, but I agree wholeheartedly with everything Hank said. I mean, we couldn't have a more articulate and inspiring president of CNU as far as I'm concerned. Let's hear it for Hank one more time. So those are wonderful elastic maps, one of which he showed. I want to show you a few more. I did this at the Green Council, and people seem to like it.
So we could watch the slides.
This is the world map showing world population. Not surprisingly, most of the people live in Asia, China, and India. Quite a few in Europe, not so many in Africa. South America is quite anemic looking. Canada even is wasted. So that's where people live. This is where fuel is used. Do we look a little bloated? Europe also. This is not per capita. This is total. If it was per capita, we'd be half the slide. Yeah, it's a pretty sad indictment. And as Hank said, the rest of the world is going to grow tired of this, and we're going to hear from them. They will be exporting more and more of their pain and unhappiness. Human poverty, even more drastically separated, not so much between north and south, but east and west. Pretty astounding, isn't it, when you see it graphically? Sewer sanitation. Look at Africa and South America. They have none. It's an unequal world. There's no doubt about that. Here's one area where the north looks better than the south. This is a forest loss. As you can see, most of it is in the developing world, but not necessarily their fault. It's often being done by first world powers and corporations, some of which have far bigger carbon footprints than entire nations now, some corporations. So that I just wanted to continue with that flavor and to show you how big the imperative is, how big the mandate is, particularly for Americans, but all for the other Western industrialized nations. It's pretty daunting. Now I want to switch completely to a different scale and a little history of passive solar, which ironically and interestingly merges with new urbanism. After the oil embargo in 73, a number of us started doing passive solar architecture. There was a lot of debate today at the Canons session about how high or low tech or how passive or active to be. A lot of us started doing this as a direct result of the oil embargo, and very simple, basic stuff. Actually, I don't think most people know what passive solar architecture is anymore. I'm not going to walk you through it, but I mean, basically, there's one moving part. It's the sun, and the building sits there, and because it's designed in a certain way, it will naturally heat, cool, ventilate, and light itself. And it is pretty timeless, and it solves a lot of our problems. It doesn't solve them all. There were products that we wished for and dreamed about when we were doing this work in the 70s, and some of them are now available. PVs are much more efficient, but they're now... We're now doing addition to our building at school where we have these movable shutters that come down and up and tilt and so on, started in Germany initially now. I mean, so I don't want to in any way preach against high tech. I think it's going to be a combination of very high, very low, of appropriate technology. It's going to really vary. So we did a lot of solar houses, and then Peter Calthorpe drew this diagram. He showed it again this morning, although a more dramatic and more accurate version of it. This is the original one, Peter. I don't know if you remember this. We were doing all those solar houses, many, many more than I showed, many firms, in sprawl. And we're basically compensating for stupid land use patterns. We were on that far left. I mean, we were moving from the far left to solar sprawl. Here the differential is rather modest. It's, in fact, I noticed in the chart this morning, almost 3-1 between sprawl and solar townhouses now. But it shows you how this is what we thought. I don't know, this is probably about 1978, 79, something like that, called the solar shadow. So obviously we are moving as fast as we can in this and other organizations towards the right on that chart. This is a naive little drawing I did about 1977. On the left was sort of the American dream. You know, it'd be a three-car garage now. But the large, useless front yard and so on and so forth. And this was sort of the naive and innocent vision we had of townhouses. The party wall came to be seen as important as the Trom wall. That solar house I first showed you is a Trom wall. How many people know what a Trom wall is? Well, that's encouraging. But, you know, the gardening, the self-sufficiency, the bicycling, and so on. This became a sort of mantra in the 70s. And we were able to actually build some of these larger multifamily projects. This is Senior Citizen, so it's only one story. It's not as dense as it could be, but the principles apply. Basic direct gain greenhouses. These turbines on the top are actually naturally ventilating. They're sort of supercharged by solar. You can see that black window up there. We should have a pointer, probably. Do we have a pointer? Oh, yeah. This is low-income senior housing. It's actually subsidized. It's the bottom of the federal subsidy chain. Very, very inexpensive. Anyway, there are greenhouses and skylights, and these things actually, these sort of agricultural vents actually work. We were starting to try to increase the density. So these are 2, 3, 4 unit stripes, east to west, north is to the left. So always stretching the buildings out east to west, getting the maximum solar exposure on the south. On the north sides typically are buffers with the entries, the airlocks, the kitchens, the bathrooms, the storage, and so on. Pretty basic ideas, but these have been pretty well forgotten since cheap oil. Since Ronald Reagan basically pulled the rug out from underneath the passive solar movement. Anyway, we were starting to get more urban about it. As you can see, the south elevations have a lot more glass than the north. There's a little glass there, but that's an unheated stairwell. This is the height of postmodernity. New urbanists probably like this architecture. I find it a little quaint and nostalgic at this point. And, you know, here's the ventilations, and I'm not going to walk you through it. But we actually started to do townhouses, but rarely applying the same principles and to three and a half story urban buildings with small front yards and alleys and so on. It was starting to get that way until energy got so cheap, it just wasn't, the demand diminished, and frankly, Peter and I and others moved on to urbanism. So in a funny way, at least the West Coast version of new urbanism came out of an environmental solar sort of experience, which was interested, among other things, in site specificity, which modernism had not been interested in. So we, in many ways, the whole idea of place, of climate-specific buildings that are sensitive to the local history, context, materials, culture, et cetera, grew out of this this passive solar movement and into something called critical regionalism and into regionalism and into urbanism and all sorts of those expressions and manifestations. So that's just a little sort of tidbit taste of a little history that relates, I think, to new urbanism. I'm stepping down as dean, and last Monday night I gave an address to about 400 faculty, staff, students, alumni, and friends, and I'm going to read a little bit from it because I think it's relevant. I talked mainly about urbanism and sustainability. Let me just say from experience with passive solar buildings 3 decades ago, we quickly learned how very, very hard it is to harvest solar energy equivalent to a gallon of gasoline. Oil is incredibly power-packed. It's easily stored, it's easily transported, it's easily converted into energy. It can produce 100 times as much energy as it takes to extract it. That's why this liquid gold has been and still is profoundly underpriced, which has lulled us into cavalier lifestyles and essentially subsidized our rapacious consumption. The planet's oil reserves are now roughly half depleted. 2008 is an amazing year. Think about it. This is the year, the UN says, the planet's going roughly from half rural to half urban. This is not just a statistical change, folks. This is a transformation in our species on a scale with going from hunter-gatherers to shepherds to farmers to an industrial society and so on. We're now going to an urban society. It's going to accelerate. We're going to be two-thirds urban and three-quarters urban before long. The next 3 billion people on the planet, if the planet can support another 3 billion of us, are going to be living in cities. It's a profound change for our species. 2008 is also the year that oil production may be peaking. This may be the year. I mean, I do know that the scientists say that even if it isn't the year it peaks, it's definitely starting to plateau. It's also the year of maybe the most important presidential election in our history and in the history of this whole sustainability planetary initiative. That's off script. Rather than just kicking ourselves for squandering this huge savings account, let's get smarter with the second half so future generations can have some of these precious fossil fuels. Saving energy is so much easier and cleaner and cheaper than producing it. Conservation and efficiency are often more cost-effective by a factor of 10, even 100, a number Masria often uses. And living in cities, which are more efficient to build, to heat, to light, and to move around, is the smartest way to save energy. And as we all know, it's the most interesting. Whether you believe, like many scientists, that we have a decade or so before more irreversible climate change or that we have longer before that tipping point, there's no question about the magnitude of this challenge. The ruins of the Mayan civilization and the desolation of Angkor Wat of ancient Cambodia bear architectural witness to the power of climate change, especially drought, its most silent killer, as rising sea level is its most obvious. Let's hope the scientists are wrong, as they have been in the past when their old models are supplanted by new ones. But obviously we'd be foolhardy to gamble when the stakes are this high. So on and so forth. There's a lot of good stuff going on, and there is reason for some cautious optimism. Just in our fields, we've got solar and wind power, the two fastest growing energy sources. We've got water conservation, revitalization of central cities, which Hank was talking about, historic preservation, brownfield redevelopment, smart growth, new urbanism, landscape urbanism, transit-oriented development, local food production. It's actually starting, maybe there is a little light at the end of the tunnel. In any case, it's clear that architects and planners have never been more central to this 5,000-year experiment we call civilization. Thanks.
I want to introduce Robin Rather, who is a good friend and colleague. Robin has been a long time involved in the Austin scene, first with the effort to really save the watershed from development, and then with a leadership role with Livable City, She's very involved in Envision Central Texas, and lately has been working with Peter Calthorpe in Louisiana on a project that just won a charter award. I'm pleased to introduce Robin Rather.
Thanks, Hank. If y'all will let me, I would like to not speak this afternoon as a planning consultant and professional. I would like to speak from the heart. I'd like to speak as a citizen of Austin and as someone who is totally freaked out about the topic of this panel. I love Austin. I'm a fourth generation Texan on both sides of my family. I got the cutest little 7-year-old boy that goes to public school right down the street from here. I so want to stand up here and give you an optimistic, inspiring, fun talk. And I can't, because it would be so dishonest. I would like to say that I love being on this panel with these guys. I think they brought the best eye candy. I did not bring a PowerPoint because I want to keep my remarks very short. I don't want to be a doomsdayer, but I want to tell you how I see it. I said I love Austin, and how can you not? It's ranked one of the top cities in livability in the whole country. It's rated one of the top places to have a business and to do business by Money Magazine. It regularly ranks both. I noticed Popular Science got into the business of ranking cities on sustainability. I don't know if y'all saw that. Another very interesting group called Sustain Lane also ranks cities on a number of metrics in sustainability. Usually Austin ranks somewhere between 10th and 15th in sustainability if you want to compare Austin to other American cities. The hell of it is, there's no way that Austin is sustainable now. I think it's getting less sustainable by the second. And there is no other American city that I would want to move to, or that we could say is a whole lot more sustainable. And I know you said this was the convenient truth panel. This is the truth that's killing me fact of our existence. I've been an environmental activist in Austin for more than 10 years. We realized a while back that no matter what we did, we would never save the environment if we didn't understand the holistic other issues, which include affordability, which include planning in general, which include getting serious about economic development. We started another nonprofit called Livable City here, which looks and works and advocates for the whole range of planning issues. But it's incredibly tough. One of the things that's tough about Austin is we get more ink for our green efforts. The metric I think we should measure is Google hits, millions of Google hits per tiny half inch of green progress. We have a great PR machine. We're not a real green city. I don't know, those of you that took tours and things, I don't know if that was obvious to the naked eye or not. I think that it was. A lot of my friends are in the audience today. I know you know what I'm talking about, and I also know you're doing everything you humanly can to fix it. I did want to briefly say what I think we do have as a city in terms of sustainability. We have a damn fine green building program, probably one of the best in the country. And if I was going to point to something here that we could honestly be proud of, we have done an incredible job in terms of green building, education about green building. Pretty much every single one of these condos that you can see from the porch here that's been built lately, almost all the condos in town are totally green or some level of green. Whether they're LEED or standard or not is another question, but they've got a lot of green attributes, and that's a wonderful thing. We have a pretty good recycling program. And we have a citizenry. This is the thing that will just break your heart about Austin. Austin has more green people in it. We have an incredibly green citizenry, really pretty sophisticated. They care about green. They vote green. They do as much green, I think, as consumers as anybody. But we're not getting it right in our town. We are just not. Some of the things that are killing us, we have toll roads, existing toll roads, and an absolutely mammoth plan for more toll roads. Most of our transportation money and almost all the discussion is about toll roads. They're not just building new toll roads here. They're tolling free roads we already paid for. That one thing, I'm afraid, is probably going to strangle out anything that we try to do to become really sustainable. And it's a serious, serious problem. Secondly, if you live in Austin, the thing that you talk about the most as you see these beautiful green condos going up and you read article after article about how great the green new urbanist deal is in Austin, what you're thinking about and what you're talking about and what you're really, really, really worried about is affordability. In Austin, we don't have the, I love those presentations on Hope 6 and all that. The affordability problem we have here has nothing to do, or very little to do, with low income issues. If you make $100,000, $120,000 household income in Austin, which, you know, by my standards is a lot of money, you have an affordability problem. So I moved here. I was born here. I spent every summer here. But I actually grew up in D.C. I moved back here in 1993, thank God. But when I moved here in 1993, you could easily rent a $300 or $400 place. That's why musicians flocked here and could stay here. The average rent here went from something in the $300 to $400, $500 range. It's like $1,300, Liz, you could probably help me out. In a short period of time, a 7 to 10 year time frame, we went from being one of the most affordable places in Texas to the least affordable place in Texas. If the message that we're sending out from our great green Austin city with its unbelievably passionate green folks is new urbanism is about stuff that only really wealthy people can afford, we are so immoral and irresponsible. We just are. So we also have, Austin is famous for, lately anyway, for having a great tech economy. I spent 20 years in the tech business, and so, you know, good for that. There's some great paying jobs. But Austin doesn't have an economic development strategy that is sustainable. It doesn't have an environment, it doesn't have, I'm going to say that again, we don't have an economic development strategy that is sustainable. And so if you take our affordability problem, our toll road problem, our economic problem, you'd be hard-pressed to get all happy here today. So I don't want to be non-optimistic. I want to stand here and say, I know we can do this, but we sure need a lot of help. And so I made a little checklist for the CNU. What y'all could do that I think would help sustainability for cities. No pressure, Hank. What you could do to help sustainability in cities in general, and specifically what I think would help Austin, because I feel like if Austin can't be a sustainable city, who in the hell can? Who can be sustainable if we can't do it? And we've been trying, but we're losing ground every minute. These are the things I would just very humbly ask for. Number one, I love it that all these projects have their very fabulous green building dimensions, green materials. We're thinking so much better from a design of individual buildings, houses, and projects. But we're not thinking systemically about infrastructure. We're not really thinking holistically about renewable energy and about transit. Austin has no transit. I was late to a dinner meeting last night. I couldn't even get a cab on the phone. If you're not driving in Austin, especially on a Friday night, you are not going anywhere. And we have to solve that systemically. Renewable energy and transportation alternatives, systemically. We need a lot of help with that. Secondly, my friend Chris Lineberger had a great panel yesterday, and I love his new book. I love almost everything he's done. But he said kind of casually that gentrification was just a natural byproduct of new urbanism, and we just needed to live with it. And people kind of shrugged. And I'm sorry, I know we're giving a lot of lip service to that, but we need to get ahead of that, and we need to do that now. This can't be. You can't move this many people out of existing urban areas and have a clean conscience. It's just, it's totally wrong. And it's going to probably totally reduced. The net positives that we're getting from all our great grand building are almost wiped out if you're displacing this many people this way. I hope this is not too much pressure. I just have a few more things. Another thing that Chris mentioned yesterday, and if you didn't read his article in The Atlantic about the new slums being McMansion areas, you absolutely have to get it. Best, most unbelievable thing I've read in a long time. But we do need a proactive fix to the what are we going to do with the empty McMansions out there. Is there something helpful that we can do with all those? I think we need to figure that out. And lastly, I feel really strongly about this. We really need to integrate economic development into new urbanism in a much, I think, a much tighter, much more effective, much, much better way. There's a great green economy to be had, not just in Austin, not just in the U.S., but all over the place, a sustainable economy. We're not going to have sustainable cities if we don't have a sustainable economy. And I didn't see that many economists walking around here mixing it up with the planners and the designers. And I think we need to get there. And I'm very optimistic about that part of it. I'm going to leave you the absolute best thing. I'm a voracious reader. Absolute best thing I've read in the last 1 year about sustainability and cities. It's a little four-page thing. You can go to ceosforcities.org and download it. It's a simple thing. What it says is, it's called, this one happens to be Portland's Green Dividend, but there's another one called Chicago's Green Dividend. And what they measured, I just love this, what they measured was if you somehow got people to drive 2 to 4 miles less per day, this particular thing looks at transit alternatives as the way to do that, but I think it would hold up, the math would hold up no matter how you did it. A small change in VMT, very small, delivers $2.6 billion a year back to the local economy in Portland. It's 2.4 in Chicago. This is not voodoo math. This is simply says every time you put a dollar at the gas pump, it's by definition going away, sometimes to very scary places. If you don't do that, you're by definition putting that money back in the local economy. And it's that sort of ROI. If we want to build sustainable cities, we have to get on top of the math and the return on investment. So what I'd like to do with the rest of my time, there are so many smart people on sustainable cities here. We'd love to do Q&A, or more importantly, some comments from you all as we wrap up this panel. Thank you.
That's right. I just wanted to pick up on one point you made, Robin. I really think also that the production of a long-lived, well-made, renewable built environment is and the capture of that economy is a big part of it. And if we actually look at how much we spend in the economy building crappy places that we throw away, largely by companies and with materials where the money leaves the local economy, I mean, I think there's an ROI from capturing how making places that we take care of over time.
Well, such a good point. And the number that we were given yesterday is that portion of the, at least the U.S. economy, is 35%.
So all of our international work, we train the people to build the places that we plan from the neighborhood. And so that's the model. And maybe we think about that.
Sorry.
I said internationally, what we try to do is create a closed loop, a neighborhood loop of the economy of building the places that we plan. So in Jamaica, we're we're stimulating new businesses to rehab the houses. We're getting a seed fund created, and then we're skilling up the people to make the houses and take care of them. It's not the total answer, but it's a piece of it. And if you extend that philosophy across a bunch of other things, you might start to add something up. Yeah, sir.
Thank you for bringing up, Robin. Thank you for bringing up the subject of economic development.
I'll get this one.
I can easily understand why this group would not want to deal with it, because you're dealing with such enormous another enormous task and issue is just even more mind-boggling. On the other hand, is what's driving growth or the need for smart growth. As I tried to bring up a couple days ago, in Austin, our growth is largely driven by companies lured here by Austin's business community, and the public has no say in this at all. So all we can possibly, if we're lucky, determine the infrastructure and how it's built, but we can't determine the kinds of businesses that locate here, or the number of them that locate here, or the number of people they bring. That's the only, the basic point I want to make.
Mm. That's a great point. Thanks, Paul.
Well, I think the new urbanism gets competent at one thing and then moves on to get competent at the next thing. So, I mean, we hopefully we're improving. Yeah.
Well, I can give you a specific example for Austin. How I, you know, what we do is, as urbanists, is look for the leverage points in the cities. About a year and a half ago, I did a plan for the North Vernon area. It's about 2,500 acres. Includes a UT campus and there's a lot of employment in that area, and the plan included a new light rail, the line was called three stations, plus a commuter line. So it had all the pieces, and it's a redevelopment plan. But the city was unable to come up with about $150,000 to do a form-based code. So all we were able to do was do the plan, but the plan was sort of hamstrung. If you can't find $150,000 to leverage an area that probably has a capitalization value of several $1 million, that to me is that's a leverage point. So I would just urge you. I don't know where the plugs are here, but I think that represents certainly a great potential in Austin, and hopefully that would be an area that actually execute the plan and make it greener, make it more economically viable, and create good housing opportunities.
Yeah. Some of the studies you've been doing on the correlation between climate change and density in cities, has anyone found like the sweet spot in densities? I know, I'm an ex-Manhattanite, kind of left there, thinking that city, just like Tokyo, won't really survive the coming energy crisis in the future, and also directly related to affordability, population density, increased land value.
Well, I mean, it's a complex question. That chart, that Newman and Kenworthy chart, actually shows that very, very high Asian densities, up to 270,000 people per square mile, doesn't actually deliver much and much at all. There's a curve, and there's a knee in the curve, and at some point there are diminishing returns to density. But Hank's other image of Chicago, New York City, if you decanted the five boroughs of New York City into New England, it would take up much of New England, more than New York State, actually, at suburban densities. So in many ways you could argue that the greenest city, not chromatically or in terms of leaf or grass cover, is in fact New York City. But whether it's gone beyond that sort of sweet spot is another question. But in America, by the way, about half the transit use in America is in New York City. If you take New York City off the chart, we look even more paltry.
But if you look at New York City across the board, it's got a certain part that's very dense and a lot of it that's not dense at all. And so, that's why people always come up with these bizarre statistics that Los Angeles is dense.
If you look at Metro New York, Hank's right. If you look at Nassau County and Suffolk County and New Jersey and so on, and Westchester, it's actually less dense because L.A. is hemmed in, as you know, by water mountains and so on.
What we found, there are a couple of things we found, that most often the high-rise under current planning is still controlled by some ideas about sunlight and separation, and those tend to, so not in a Singapore or a Hong Kong setting, but in a London or a, you know, an Omaha or a Europe setting, that you don't tend to get exponential increases in density with increases in height because of the amount of space that you need, that you tend to leave around them. I think, I mean, I what we found with our analyses was that actually it is that notion of the perimeter block that is where you get the most cover is sort of the six stories to four to ten story European perimeter block is a very efficient way of getting a lot of people and a lot of jobs, and then it has a side benefit, I think, of creating enough density to spread retail and street life throughout a large part of the city. And the question now, that doesn't say that you shouldn't have really dense, tall office concentrations in certain areas. And there are certain reasons for large floor plate buildings and concentrations in financial centers and all those things. But I think it's, you know, I think it's from the row house to the to the mid-rise flat, or sort of that's where you most often want to be. Doug will probably disagree. But,
well, no, I mean, I think there is definitely a room in the palette for high-rise buildings. Yeah. But what is high-rise? Is it 20, 40, 60? I mean, that's a whole other debate.
No, there was a debate about that.
Yeah, earlier, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
That affects walkability. And we're, for instance, in Jeddah in January doing a charrette, and Jeddah is extraordinarily dense, you know, 6 to 10 stories of mixed use environment with very few people walking. Of course, they have cheap gas. But also, the streets were designed terribly. No sidewalk, no walkway, and block sizes were too large. And they got everything wrong but the high density. Howard, Mr. Kegler here, we were on the tour.
The way we are trying to do it is we're trying to look at density, connectivity, and we work with Bill Hillier's firm, Space Syntax, to really model permeability and connectivity, and then it's access to public transport. So it's jobs and houses within a quarter mile of transit, and those together is what we would call location efficiency, and they really are the core metrics. Mixed use then is permitted and works because when those conditions are present as well, I think. And, yeah.
I'd like to bring this conversation and see if I can bring it to this sort of brink that each one of you I found was alluding to. Hank, you're showing these amazing new towns that are being developed in England, but also showing in Jamaica and in various places around the country, Sierra Leone, devastated, incredibly devastated populations in places that aren't able to keep up with the world. Robin, you're just heartfelt, you know, sense of something's deeply wrong right here in Oz. And Doug, your amazing maps of the world, kind of like a mirror to see them. It was
Carnival.
Stretch you out the mind, right? Each one of those are sort of talking about really some serious issues here in the next 50, 100 years in our children's lives. Particularly, Doug, you know, the peak of oil. What's New York City going to be like when the energy drops off? Are we really going to be finding another energy source that's going to come close to keeping us at this level? What is urbanism going to look like and going to need to look like in 50 to 100 years?
Well, Jim Kunstler, Jim Kunstler has some definite opinions he'll be sharing with us tomorrow. He doesn't believe in high rises because he doesn't think we'll have the power to run the elevators. I think that's a little simplistic. But the problem is our whole economy, our whole paradigm is based on material growth and abundance. somehow we've got to figure out a way to base it on human growth and abundance. I know that sounds very idealistic and maybe naive, but I mean, everybody wants economic growth. That's half the questions are about economic growth. And how I want it too in my town. But in fact, it's irrevocably and intrinsically linked to the very issues we're talking about.
That's the slide I didn't dare show, actually. Yeah. I mean, I showed the one about decoupling GDP from resource use, but I didn't show the one about decoupling, you know, society from GDP.
And that's the big gorilla in the whole capitalist system is based on that, on growth, and we're not. It's a sleeping giant ticking bomb.
I didn't think they were ready for that.
Yeah, I don't think. Are you ready for that? You have a question.
I was going to say that I have seen many discussions where we did national accounting differently and took into account resource depletion in doing those national accounts like GDP. What I was going to ask, though, was what do you all think about other factors besides just the built environment that we have to work on? Because with regard to what Robin said, I see a need for significant changes in the psychology of the individuals that live in areas like this. We could do all the good new urbanist development in Austin or cities like Phoenix and Atlanta along railway stations and major corridors and whatnot, but there is this ingrained, inherent belief that the Constitution and the Bible guarantees people the right to drive everywhere they go. And we need to have a long-term education process to show them that you can enjoy a high quality of life living the way I do with riding my bike and riding the bus and other people do.
Well, by the way, I'm going to add that to my checklist, the can't have great sustainable cities without a lot of therapy, if that's what I heard you say correctly.
We need work in sociology as well as in architecture.
I absolutely agree with you. There's a tremendous film, a documentary made here, actually by an actor in The Sopranos who lives here and is a screenwriter in his spare time called Nobility. And it's interviews with the leading Nobel Prize winners. And at the South by Southwest screening here, the main conversation was about how to prepare our kids for, emotionally, prepare our kids for solving the problems that we are giving them. It was really a powerful moment. I just wanted to get back and answer your question. I do have a drop of optimism. I can really see a future 50 years from now when the oil's all gone. And I don't think that I came out of the tech industry, as I said, I don't think we're going to magically figure out the hydrogen economy is just going to magically make all these problems, you know, quite manageable. I think the future's going to look a lot like the past. We got along just fine and had excellent economies a long time ago in a little more pastoral way. I don't think that economic growth has always meant what it means to us now. We have a particularly rapacious and greedy understanding of economic development. It isn't impossible. That isn't the only kind of economy that we can have and still grow. And I'm maybe it's instinct, but I'm very confident that there's an economy that's fair and balanced, that works for us, that has nothing to do with oil. It's there.
That's the best thing to see in you would work at,
to find
what that economy is.
That might be beyond our professional skill.
I'm sorry, I
want to... Or anybody's.
Respond to your question about psychological change. I mean, obviously, we have to work at that, and CNU and other, in every walk of life and everything we do. I think, though, pricing is really critical. We were right about the Vietnam War. It didn't matter. We've been right a lot about it. I mean, the moral imperative, the moral argument doesn't always prevail. I mean, what's changing...
Does it ever prevail? I mean...
Well, sometimes it does. I mean, it has...
Just checking.
Probably has in this room with these people. But what seems to change behavior more is the economic... I mean, the Europeans, Harold here, representing, they're not on a higher moral plane than the Americans. I think they behave differently for economic reasons. Energy's been expensive for a long time there. It's just a different... Now, I know there are cultural reasons and so on, but I think the cultural roots of Europe and America aren't that different. I think economics have a lot to do with it. I mean, I don't want to sort of remove it from the moral and spiritual and social sphere, but that'll get us a long way there. And we've been, as I said, profoundly underpricing energy, and that will change us.
Well, we've certainly seen with congestion pricing in London, where I live, we've seen a dramatic change. We've seen a fourfold increase in bicycle use. We've seen a I think a 200% increase in bus use, and the tube is so crowded I can't stand to get in it anymore. And that's as a result of pricing. The other thing I would say is that these studies that I cited show that when you provide those physical conditions, people change their behavior. And there are ways that we can support, and they show that when those situations are in place, people drive less. So, yes, Americans love to drive their car. I actually now, as a good American who knew that driving a car meant being able to get out of the house and go with your girlfriend somewhere where nobody could see you, I hate to drive now, you know, and so I've changed, and that's not just ideological, it's a drag. The other thing I think is that there's emergent evidence that programs like travel behavior change programs, which actually target people when they're at a point when they're open, when they move house or they move job or they do other things, if you provide them evidence of alternatives, sometimes a free bus pass for a month or something like that, bicycle maintenance, there is sustained changes in travel behavior that can happen. So there's a role for providing alternatives for people and making a difference as well. Jeff?
I just want to say I kind of agree with Doug. I think $4, $5, $6 buck a gallon gasoline is going to seriously
help
us out there. I don't know about parking, but I pretty much promise you
it's going to be $8, $10 bucks before long.
Yep. It's the last question.
This idea about growth, it's time to get into this discussion. I mean, didn't do the slide. If you go back to the limits of growth back in the 70s and the Woodlands conferences where the word sustainable growth was first used, and George Mitchell challenged that and said that didn't seem right, because in his mind Harvard had never grown it, developed. It had to be sustainable development. Nothing can grow sustainably. We have to get to that. We know populations are supposed to
develop rather than grow.
2040 to 50. What happens to an economy that's supposed to be about more people when there aren't more people? And the other thing is to remember that those people who wrote The Limits to Growth some years later wrote Beyond the Limits, in which they made the case that if everybody on Earth can live a lifestyle similar to what you see in Southern Europe, problem over.
Yeah.
I don't know if they would still say that, but that was an interesting concept, because if you're thinking about places like Tuscany and so on, it sounds okay, doesn't it? But it's a much more Earth-centered
Full of English people who drive around all the time now and talk to everybody. All right, I think that's all the time we have. Thanks to our panel.
Thank you, Tina. Thank you.
And thank you all for helping us with the discussion. It was great discussion.
Thank you.